Welcome to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. Thank you for listening in. I'm your host for today, Susan Franzen, together with my co-host, Paul Wearson.
Well, good morning, Susan. How are you? Today's show is a deep look at the nature of central Iowa. We have two true experts with us today to discuss how farming developed as it has in Iowa and where it may go in the future.
Yes, we do. And I'm delighted that Steve Lekwa and Adam Yankee can both be with us live today. Steve is former Story County Conservation Director, whose views on wildlife and the environment appear in his column, Naturally Speaking, in local papers in our listening area. Adam Yankee is the new Extension Wildlife Specialist at ISU, with a special interest in habitat for game species in Iowa, a topic that will catch the attention of bird lovers and hunters alike. At the end of the show, we'll have announcements of a couple of events coming up this weekend and another important person in the natural world. But that's for... stay tuned and find out.
Well, it's great to welcome both of you here today. We have Steve and Adam. And Steve, let's start with you. Tell us about your involvement with the conservation here in central Iowa and Story County. When did you begin your job there at Story County Conservation?
Well, I started my job in January of 1973. Hickory Grove Park was the primary face of Story County Conservation at that time, and it was brand new. There were still dead trees sticking up through the water around the lake from when they flooded the ravine that became the lake. My first job was to go start topping those trees off above the ice and turning them into firewood. So that's how I spent my first winter with Story County Conservation.
And then when you began, how many employees were there at Story County Conservation?
There were the director, Mr. Pinnicky, myself as an intern park ranger, and kind of a field operations superintendent, Al, so there were three of us that worked full-time, and then there was one that we called a senior park aide, and there was another guy who was a college intern like myself that within a couple months was off to his first permanent job.
And then when you retired, how large was the organization?
We had, I believe, 16 full-time people.
So it grew a great deal and a lot of change occurred.
It certainly has, yes, a 450-acre primary park with a couple of smaller satellite areas to an operation that currently is managing over 3,500 acres in Story County.
You know, I'm proud to hear that because it shows that somewhere along the line, people began to prioritize things differently than they may have been doing in the 50s when we grew up. You know, so there's much more awareness, much more, I hope, funding given to this project over those years.
Yes.
But what I want to talk about is really some history here, geologically and, you know, how Iowa developed. You know, when you're looking at the settlers first coming into Iowa, what did they see?
Free land, for one thing, or nearly free. They were people who wanted more than anything to have a place of their own where they could raise enough crops to feed their family, and maybe someday, with luck, enough that they'd have something to sell. Initially, that wasn't even in the cards. You raise enough to get by till the next year.
And what was the land that they saw when they got here?
Okay.
Geologically, in terms of, was it wet? Was it dry? Was it wooded?
Yes. Well, if you're looking at our neighborhood, and I say our because Paul and I grew up in the same area, south of Story City, wet, to say the least, poorly drained, heavy organic, tight soils. They settled along the streams where drainage was better because out on the open prairies, amongst the potholes and things, their technology just didn't allow them to farm those lands effectively. The first people who had to move out onto the prairies to begin taming the prairie sod were almost a whole nother class of pioneer. People who lived in the valleys feared for them because of the dangers of living out away from the shelter of the valley. But then things like John Deere's, the man John Deere, and his steel plow allowed them to begin to break that sod. And only after a period of time did people begin to realize that the ones who lived out on the open prairie were the lucky ones in terms of soil, not the ones who settled down in the valley where their original technology allowed them to break fields, clear some small clearings, and plant their simple crops. So the black gold that the prairies and wetlands had left us finally could be mined, so to speak, once people began to turn that soil. And later on, really quite later on, late in the 1800s, began to drain those wetlands. Initially, they farmed around them. When you were farming with a couple of horses or an oxen or two, it was not hard with a one-person walk-behind plow to just plow an acre here, a couple there, where the ground was high enough and dry enough to farm. As technology improved and things, and they began to ditch drain, and then eventually, as the technology developed tile drain wetlands, they began, at least the shallow ones, farming right through them.
So that's when we date that, we're talking about Iowa being settled in the 1830s, 40s, before that maybe?
East of here. Here, the initial settlement was later in the 1850s. The first settlement of European people was in the late 40s down around Collins in southeast Story County. But over the next decade, places like our hometown, Story City, got on the map, back then known as Fairview. Ames didn't exist yet. Gilbert didn't exist. But within the next 50 years, virtually every place that we know today was there. We would recognize the names of the places and in some cases even the buildings. We're a young country yet.
Did you say within the last 50 years?
Within the next 50 years, from basically initial settlement in the early 1850s, mid-1850s, to total establishment, total control, total elimination of the prairie, most of the wetlands, all took place in 50 years.
So now we're talking about, I've heard, the most altered ecologically state in the Union. 95% of our land has been altered to accommodate agriculture. Is that right, Steve? Is that a figure?
That is the primary activity on the land. Of course, sitting where we are today, you see there's lots more than that. But agriculture was the initial taming of the land, plowing out the prairies, draining the wetlands. Where we sit today was poorly drained, wet soil, over by the railroad. Frequently told anecdotes of people getting off the train at the new depot, which didn't come into Ames until middle years after the Civil War, shooting ducks off the prairie pothole ponds within easy walk of the train station and then getting on the train again. So
it's difficult to imagine that, you know. Over where the Village Inn is, I just picture waterfowl over there. Well, we want to bring in Adam Yankee, too. And Adam, welcome. Adam is originally from Indiana, and you might tell us what your position is at Iowa State with the Extension.
Okay, yeah. So my title is Wildlife Extension Specialist there. Local folks, and this works all the time for me, know me as the new Jim Pease. So that, I use that to my advantage across the state. So
he was a celebrity, and you're going to
sure
coattail
was. Yeah, well, we'll see.
Well, now tell me what your responsibility is there at Iowa State.
So I have a mix of responsibilities there. I teach a little bit at the university, certainly not as much as traditional professors do, but and then I also do research. The majority of my appointment is this extension responsibilities. And so anything related to wildlife in the state comes to me. My interests and expertise are in wildlife conservation, specifically wildlife habitat conservation. So that's where I spend a majority of my time. And do educational programs across the state, and also try to write and provide resources online and elsewhere for folks to learn about wildlife and the major challenges wildlife face in the state.
So you keep very busy, and you're traveling the state making presentations, educating people, letting them know what the current status is, what to do about what we don't like and what we need to change, right?
Yeah, but do spend a lot of time on the road, which I enjoy, getting to know Iowa and seeing the landscape.
Well, welcome to Iowa to a Hoosier. Hoosier. Did I say Hoosier? A Hoosier. And I hope you like Iowa. It's
yeah,
a nice
sure
place. I grew up here. I'm in favor of Iowa, definitely.
Well, I'm going to guess that your ethnic ancestry probably fits in well in this North Story County area.
Yeah.
Iowa. Yankee? Yeah.
Yeah.
Any name that ends in K-E or S-O-N.
And they pronounce their yays as
yeah,
Ys.
Yeah, the Y.
You know that, you know that they're going to fit right in.
That's right. Somewhere north of the fjord. But now what we're talking about really is both of you folks are dealing with the effects of the change that all the evolution that Steve described bring us to our present situation. And so we're talking about actually conserving the land and the wildlife and providing habitat for them. And I'm wondering, you know, it seems to me from a layperson's point of view that there was an extreme tendency to cut habitat and without thought to the overall ecology. Farming just sort of expanded for a long time without consideration of these issues. Is that right? Steve, is that?
Oh, yeah. Farming, as I said before, was pretty much a subsistence occupation. Wildlife was a source of protein because you didn't slaughter probably your only cow just to have beef.
No, exactly.
You go out and shoot a deer. Or in the earliest years, there might even been a bison or an elk or two left. The last of those disappeared in the 1860s and
70s. In the 1860s, the elk disappeared.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. 1870 up in northwest Iowa, 70-something, was the last wild elk. I think 66 or so was the last wild bison up in north-central Iowa. And people ate those, too. Those two animals are recorded in Jim Dinsmore's book as becoming food. That's what you did. The same with the prairie chickens that were so numerous. Eventually, you had enough excess in your production of beef or hogs or whatever, chickens, that you could start eating some of the protein you raised. But in those initial years, it was just a resource to be used to stay alive. And then as time went on, there was money to be made by draining wetlands. Those were wasteland. There was not seen as any particular value in them. They were just in the way. Only in recent years have we come to realize that those had very real ecologic functions within the landscape. And as we began to depend more and more on artificial fertilization of the land, they didn't fertilize in the early years. The native nutrition of the soil was all that was there, and it was plenty. We found that those wetlands were great at denitrifying the runoff, capturing the phosphates that we put on the land to raise the crops we do. So only when it became economically important or culturally important to protect our water quality and things did those things begin to come back into view as something we could work with and to encourage. For most of the 1900s, the available funding streams were for draining the wetlands, were for plowing the native grassland, putting more land into production. That's where the money was. But it's the latter part of the 1900s and into the 2000s, we're seeing a renewed interest in those natural values that permanent grasslands, that wetlands can provide.
And when you look at the cultivated land, it's certainly true, I would guess, that fence lines and all the vegetation that grows up between the fields is a little slice of habitat for a lot of animals.
Very little, but all there is. That's disappearing.
Well, you know, that was my next point. When I grew up, there were a lot of smaller fields with a lot of fence line, and a lot of those fences were taken down, and I assume a real shrinkage of habitat when you look at it all in one big, aggregate, that a lot of habitat's been removed that used to be there. Mm-hmm. So it's even more intensive with larger fields. And we're really talking about habitat.
We are.
And, Adam, what's the prognosis here? Do you see ways to increase habitat and enhance the opportunity for wildlife in Iowa, given our intensive agriculture?
Sure, yeah. You're right. Describing sort of the historical land use, wildlife used to find more opportunities on the margins. We had, of course, a lot more diverse crop rotations back then, and so just different crops rather than our modern rotation just focuses on corn and soybeans. Those different crops, particularly small grains, provided habitat even in the field. And then, of course, today our fields are a lot cleaner than they used to be thanks to herbicides, which has improved productivity in the farm, but those weeds were pretty good wildlife habitat, and so that presents with a challenge as well. So the opportunities, I think, that we're excited about in modern working landscapes are the coupling wildlife habitat opportunities with addressing major challenges like water quality and soil health. And so I am kind of optimistic that we'll find these opportunities to get wildlife back into working landscapes by, for example, having high diversity plantings and buffer strips along streams that prevent sediment transport from the fields into the surface waters. Also things like restoring wetlands, like Steve was talking about. We historically didn't understand the important ecological function that wetlands played in our landscape, and today we know them to be the kidneys of the landscape. They filter the water.
That's a good analogy.
Yeah. So we didn't really always understand that. We didn't think about the role that wetlands play, both in terms of cleaning the water and then also just sequestering the water from floods. And so we see a lot of opportunities to put wetlands back into landscapes where, frankly, we're still not very good at growing crops in wetlands. You can drive around Story County or anywhere in the state and find areas that consistently, despite cultivation, planting, and putting a lot of inputs in, don't yield a crop. Because if during key life phases of those plants they have wet feet, as we say, the plants just simply won't survive and grow. So it's those areas, finding those areas where we're not actually yielding a crop, and we have potential to positively impact other important societal values like soil health and water quality, that we can get wildlife habitat back into these lands.
And so you're out there talking to people about making that happen, encouraging. Is your audience farmers to a large degree?
It depends. Extension, I think, has a good tie with a lot of agricultural producers, so I'm always excited to get a chance to talk to farmers and landowners. And then, of course, we also talk to everybody from master gardeners to big production operators. I kind of say I'll talk to any of them because everything we do on the land impacts wildlife. And so people with a city backyard or a 640-acre field all kind of have a role to play. So,
well, you know, looking back, Steve, this is what my experience was. I grew up in an era when a family could be supported on 160 acres. Now, our plot of land there was usually divided into a oats field, a corn field, a bean field, and alfalfa.
Okay.
Yeah. And so we rotated those plots every year, and that had to increase habitat for animals that, you know, love grass and cover. And that was quite a little stretch of land there, and it varied every year according to where it was located. Mm-hmm. But that's not the way we farm anymore.
Excuse me, I'm going to have to break in with a pitch. This is a wonderful conversation, and I think about the education that people who don't happen to have land to convert into changes that will bring back habitat, but might be interested in going out and hunting a pheasant or two, would like to hear. This is what KHOI provides, and I think that this kind of conversation is pretty unique, with our interviewer getting so excited about the connections with our guests. And so we urge our listeners to become members. This is a good time to do it. And so you can hear more of this programming because you are what keeps programs like this on the air with your memberships, your $50 basic membership or $50 or $100 if you feel a little more able to help us. And, of course, we really, really would like to have more sustaining members at $20 a month or $250 a year.
Yes, it's our fall membership drive, so we're interrupting a little bit to do that because KHOI is supported by people who want to have this kind of radio available in the area where so many people are involved here who are volunteers. There are people who do shows on KHOI regularly who are volunteers. They're not paid staff. They love radio, and they love communicating with the people in our listening area, and we love talking about things that are important to you out there. Susan and I, typically on this local talk show, highlight activities in all the surrounding communities. Slater, Story City, you name it, Boone, Webster City, we've been there to promote and explore all the activities and things going on in small towns, from community theater to all the festivals that are held during the summer. And so we really encourage you now to become a member at KHOI. And Susan, do you want to give us any details on how to do that?
You can call 515-292-2878, or this is new to me, text at 515-200-7758. 515-200-7758 on your smartphone, or by clicking the donate button on the KHOI main page.
So become a member as soon as you can. And
yes,
if you've just joined us, we've been talking today with Adam Yankee, who is the person at Iowa State University working with the Extension and he's in wildlife, aren't you?
That's right.
And then we're talking also with Steve Lekwa, longtime director of the Story County Conservation Unit. And he's retired now and enjoying his retirement. But we've been talking about habitat and how farming has impacted that and what's being done today to, in view of the fact that farming is done the way it's done, how do we increase habitat? How do we make things more amenable to wildlife? And what can we do to alter what's been done that probably needs to be done over and changed? And so, Adam, that's largely what you're about, getting the word out, talking to people, letting them know what can be done.
Sure. Well, and one of the things I always like to emphasize is the success stories that we have. And, of course, that owes to the hard work of people that came into the field far before I was here. But we know some of these things are possible. We've brought back, at the turn of the 20th century, we didn't have white-tailed deer in Iowa. We didn't have wild turkeys, bobcats, river otters, very few bald eagles. And by the early 20th century, we didn't have any bald eagles. And prairie chickens, just a laundry list of species that we once didn't have in Iowa and we have brought back. And that's thanks to the hard work of, the State Wildlife Resource Agency, the DNR, and also the wonderful work that county conservation boards do, and then, of course, motivated private landowners. So that's one of the messages I like to take out across the state, is that these aren't sort of unprecedented times. We have a lot of successes to build on, and we just have to find ways to have more bobwhites in the landscape or more ringneck pheasants or wild turkeys.
Well, now, Steve, when we grew up, deer were kind of rare.
They were.
When we were on a road trip, you got points for different animals. And a deer was a very high point level because you couldn't see many. And now, I remember I saw Ashton Kutcher, the movie star from Iowa. He was a guest on Jay Leno. And he said, there's nobody in Iowa who hasn't hit a deer. And, it's true. I'm one of the few people who haven't hit a deer, knock on wood. And so basically we're talking about, in my lifetime, it seems to me, anecdotally, vast increase in deer populations. Right, Steve?
That's true. And it goes back to the basics of what any wild creature relates to. And when we talk habitat, we're really talking five separate things that we mix and balance. There's, of course, food, water, shelter, cover, we call it, in the field. And then there's space, just enough physical space for that species to be comfortable in its life process. And then lastly, how all those different components are arranged. Food typically anymore is not a limiting factor for that wildlife we still have. There's more waste grain in the fields right now, literally right now as the harvest goes on, than they used to be able to harvest. Literally, there's more on the ground out there now than great-great-grandpa could hand-pick. But if all of that is here and the only suitable roosting habitat or cover during storm escapes is way over here, the energy expenditure to get from the cover to the habitat is greater than can be gained by consuming and digesting that food. In addition, you're exposed to predation the whole time you're out away from the cover. So those days of small fields with fence rows every 30, 40 acres, long, long gone. Now they really, unless it's planned for, and many landowners do deliberately, even at their own expense, make allowances for wild things.
You know, I never thought of that. To get that food source, they have to walk across this no man's land.
That's correct.
Where they're exposed to predation, and the journey might be so long that it would burn up most of what they'd eat anyway.
It's a little bit nippy this morning, but our wildlife can handle weather like this. If they're wet and the wind is blowing hard, they're subject to wind chill just like we are, and you throw in a ground blizzard situation, and a pheasant isn't equipped to handle that. If they have to spend extended periods of time out in the open just to get at feed, they're not going to thrive.
Just more specific to this current season, how is our pheasant supply this year? How does it look?
Well, from what I have heard, and this is anecdotal, Adam probably has more up-to-date information, the statewide counts, the surveys that are done, were down slightly this year. But the most telling ones, we call it the August Roadside Survey, is done in August, and they depend on dewy mornings. Pheasants hate being wet. Oh. So they'll go out on the road shoulders in the early morning,
is
get out of
right?
that.
They hate being wet.
They get out of the grass where it's all wet and dewy and sit on the road shoulder to dry off and warm up. And there they can be seen and counted. This year in August, we didn't have many dewy mornings. It was hot. It was dry. And pheasants didn't have to leave the cover. So even though the drivers were out doing those routes, they weren't seeing the birds. The count numbers were down. Anecdotally, in those areas where there is habitat to support them, we think there are going to be some pretty good pockets of population.
And Adam, you could verify that, yeah. Right?
Well, that's exactly what I would have said, what Steve just said. That was the story coming out of the statewide August surveys. And we were all interested to see what those numbers were this year, because we know what really drives pheasants. Of course, habitat is the biggest thing. But then annual variations outside of habitat are driven by severe winter weather. And that's true for bobwhites and for pheasants, because, like we said, they have to get through those winters and avoid the hawks and owls and all the other mouths that want to feed on them and stay warm and feed. So in Iowa has been fortunate the last number of years. I don't know, maybe going back five consecutive, maybe seven consecutive winters have been pretty mild. And all of those mild winters have led to sort of a buildup of bobwhites in southern Iowa, and then also we think pheasants. But this year a lot of us going into August were excited to see those roadside numbers because we thought they'd be higher. And then just like Steve described, the weather didn't cooperate. And what I always tell folks is it's hard to count people. The census is a big ordeal, and there's a lot of people knocking on doors, so it's really hard to count wildlife when they don't answer the phone or come to their door. So
when we say habitat, if we're going to focus on pheasants here just a little bit longer, and I hate to do that because wildlife is so much bigger than just pheasants. That said, if it supports pheasants, it's probably going to be supporting meadowlarks, bobolinks, and many other species that some of us value. But saying that pheasants need certain kind of habitat, people say, well, pheasants eat corn, right? Right enough this time of year. Those young birds that most pheasants we see are a year or younger old. Very few of them live into that second and much less third year. As they're growing from a little ping pong ball sized puff to a 2 pound bird or pound and a half or something for a hen, in just 2-3 months' time, they have to have vast amounts of protein, animal protein, bugs. That's what they eat. If the habitat doesn't provide that, all the corn in the world isn't going to provide you a single pheasant, because that's not what growing pheasants eat. They only begin shifting to hard foods like weed seeds and corn as they mature into that first fall. Everything up to that point has been dependent on animal protein in the form of insects, crickets, grubs, things like that.
One more thing I didn't know when I got up this morning. This last half hour has vanished quickly. We've been talking with Adam Yankee and Steve Lekwa, and they have given me all kinds of new stuff to think about, and I hope they have to you, our listeners at home, too, because we need to be aware of these things. In an agricultural state like Iowa, with all the things going on with agriculture, and in the fields everywhere, I see large coils of tiling being installed.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So these are very timely topics. Thank you, Adam and Steve, the old and the young, as I'm old.
Catching up on you, Paul.
Yeah, well, I know you are, about 2 years. And then, Adam, I hope you enjoy your stay in Iowa, maybe a permanent one. Yeah. He's a native Hoosier. And he's out at Iowa State University. Thank you both for being on today.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, it's been fun.
Yeah, thanks for coming in.
This is KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people's stories and events in central Iowa and also our landscape. Since much of our listening area consists of land and waterways, we also devote frequent programs to the natural world. And that's what we're doing in the first half of the show. So we have a little music break.
Well, I think it's fine building jumbo planes, taking a ride into cyberspace. Switch on summer from a slot machine. Just get what you want to if you want, 'cause you can get anything. I know we've come a long way, changing day to day, but tell me, where do the children play? Where do you roll on roads over fresh green grass? For your lorry loads, pumping petrol gas, and you make them long, and you make them tough, but they just go on and on, and it seems that you can't get off. No, I know we've come a long way, changing day to day, but tell me, where do the children play? Sky. fingers cry. Yes, will you tell us when to live?
When we ask for your membership during the Fall Fun Drive, we remind you that KHOI brings you stories and entertainment you'll find nowhere else in central Iowa. Of course, we try to include our nearest neighbors, Nevada, Boone, and Story City. But a meeting that has a little out of our listening area, like the one up at Luther College that we're going to be talking about with Rick Zarwell. He just stopped in yesterday and told Pat Schlarbaum about it, and Pat recorded this. So we're going to play this to bring you to a different kind of landscape.
Well, today we have Rick Zarwell from Lansing, Iowa, a birder extraordinaire, retired from the Natural Resource Conservation Service. And what brings you to central Iowa, Rick?
I'm doing some bird surveys in Madison and Adair counties here for a large wind turbine project that's proposed for this area.
So you're an environmentalist that does field studies, but I understand there's an upcoming public meeting that I'd like to share with our listeners.
Yes. I'd like to tell you about an event that's coming up on Thursday of this week, on November 9th. It's going to begin at 6:30 in Velders Hall, Luther College, Decorah, Iowa. And we have had a number of issues in northeast Iowa on the CAFOs and the sighting of CAFOs. And so the title is CAFOs Water Quality Forum, and CAFO stands for a Consolidated Animal Feeding Operation. And we've had a number of proposed CAFOs in our area that impact our trout streams and our groundwater and our quality of life, basically. And so at this forum, this coming Thursday here, we have seven panelists, and we're going to discuss things like the Master Matrix that's 15 years old now, and it was basically written by four of the industry, and it failed in many, many cases.
And that is the permit process that the Department of Natural Resources requires in a master matrix set of documents.
It's right. It's a scoring system, and there's no negative points. You can't lose points on anything. It's just a matter of adding and adding and adding until you get your permit. Many of us believe that it's failed to protect local people, landowners, farmers, towns, and cities. So we're going to discuss that at this forum. And also a couple of issues there in northeast Iowa, Bloody Run Creek, which is between Monona and McGregor. There's another proposed CAFO between Lansing and Waukon. And we're going to go over a number of legislative updates that are being brought forward. And one of the interesting protective measures is a restrictive covenant concept that one of our local attorneys in Decorah has come up with. So all those things are going to be discussed with the seven panelists here on CAFO/Water Quality Forum, Thursday, November 9th at Luther College in Decorah.
And I understand the number seven of your participants. Could you give us a rundown of some of those individuals?
Sure. One of Larry Stone is going to discuss the Bloody Creek, Bloody Run Creek issue in Clayton County. Larry is a retired outdoor writer for the Des Moines Register and well known with his photography and writing. Mm-hmm. Steve Falk is an attorney from Des Moines. We'll be talking about some of the legislative updates. The attorney, local attorney, Carl Knutson, will be talking about the restrictive covenant concept that he came up with.
Yeah, we want to develop that a little further, but who are the rest of the participants?
Monty Marty is going to discuss the CAFO issue between Waukon and Lansing.
Well, the covenant aspect to this is, I read about it in the Des Moines Register, so give us some background on how that is essential to this type of siting of these confinement animal feeding operations.
Yeah, it's a covenant is a legal structure that landowners can enter into, and you can restrict any number of things really on your property. And the what's being brought forward here is a covenant that says that the land, say Farmer X out there on the landscape says, I'm going to enter into a restrictive covenant, but we're not going to accept any hog manure from hog confinements. And it's a legal entity. You'd write this up, and it restricts that. It's just it's a covenant, and it can be used to restrict frac sand mining or any number of things like that. It's a covenant that's a lot like an easement that other conservation entities have used over the years. In this case, it's just focused right on using the manure from these CAFOs.
And the local control, I guess, is probably the big umbrella issue here. So these landowner covenants or neighbors uniting is essentially adapting to the fact that they really have not had a voice in what happens.
That's exactly right, Pat. You know, the big focus of this forum is really how local we can regain local control over some of these major decisions that impact not only just water quality at the surface or groundwater, but really quality of life for local communities and local groups of landowners. And so this covenant is one technique to be used that way. And ultimately, we'd like to return local control on the CAFOs and many other issues, actually, back to the counties. We elect county supervisors to make those decisions for us, and that responsibility has been taken away by the state legislature.
So I guess carpooling would be a great option for people to realize and have the destination once more, please.
This is going to be held at Valders Hall, which is the Science Hall on Luther College campus in Decorah, Iowa, this coming Thursday, November 9th, and it's going to begin at 6:30. And we certainly encourage carpooling. It's a good idea.
Well, and the
it's free. It's also, I should mention to you, Pat, it's free and open to the public, no cost.
Yeah, it'd be great to have a turnout. And quite frankly, this may be a new option for people to pursue with their environmental interests to basically provide some environmental protection locally that our legislature and our agencies hand in glove with the animal industry.
That's right, Pat. I should mention, too, that that we're not opposed to agriculture. We're just saying that there should be some control, and sometimes these proposed CAFOs are just proposed for the wrong locations.
Yeah.
But this master matrix has not served its purpose in guiding the siting of these CAFOs. It's just failed, and it's been 15 years of failures, and we're looking for some solutions to that issue. And we want to work with agriculture and the animal. We all like pork. We all like beef. We like these things. But there's got to be some common sense in where these CAFOs are sited. And that's what we're looking for.
Is there anything else that comes to mind that would be a good bit of information to share?
Yes, indeed. We're working on a number of things that I am in Northeast Iowa. One of the ones that shows a lot of promise is a new organization called the Iowa Coldwater Conservancy. And it's a group of people that are forming to take care of our precious trout streams. We really have unique streams and rivers in Northeast Iowa for trout fishermen. People come from all over the nation to fish these areas. And this is going to be the Iowa Coldwater Conservancy is a partnership not only of Trout Unlimited chapters in the Hawkeye Fly Fishers Association, but we're going to partner with all kinds of educational institutions, corporations, government agencies. And it's going to be a big, big partnership. We're just getting started. I was fortunate to be asked to be on the board of directors, and we're still seeking a few more board members to join us. It's brand new, and it's got some really important responsibilities dealing with these precious cold water streams that trout live in, which are pretty unique to Northeast Iowa, at least we feel they are. And we want to manage those watersheds and keep things like manure out of our sinkholes and our springs and in our streams and rivers.
Okay, so a sinkhole is a bit of your unique topography on the landscape where an opening on the surface is directly connected to our groundwater hundreds of feet below.
That's correct. Interestingly enough, I spoke with the mayor of Fairfield, and Fairfield, of course, is in southeastern Iowa. I spoke with him a couple weeks ago, and he is tapping into the same Jordan sandstone, the same aquifer that begins on the surface of the land in Alma Key and Winnesheek and Clayton counties, and they're getting their drinking water from that aquifer down in Fairfield, Iowa, hundreds of miles away. So we don't want to contaminate that land surface and that drainage through sinkholes and fissures in the karst topography. Well, what is in that water on the surface goes right into that aquifer, and eventually, you know, a lot of Iowans are going to be drinking it. That's just not a good situation at all. It's not sustainable, and we need to protect that. So that's one of the things that the Iowa Cold Water Conservancy is looking at.
Yeah, we are all connected. So a prime example there of Jefferson County in far southeast Iowa, same water aquifer that goes through Alma Key and Clayton and Howard County. Many counties to the north, hundreds of miles.
That's right. Yeah, the former state geologist, Robert Libra, told me that approximately 15% of municipalities in Iowa get their drinking water from this Jordan Aquifer, and some of those are south of Des Moines, west of Mason City. And of course, I just learned about this one down in Fairfield. So it's widespread. And Iowans get a huge proportion of their drinking water from wells. And most of that water starts in northeast Iowa because the geology, the underground geology, slopes south and southwest and west from that northeast corner. So that's something we're really concerned about.
So a good opportunity to learn more about the Iowa Cold Water Conservancy and how this group can set some precedents in dealing with our industrial-scaled agriculture here in Iowa, seeking some solutions to preserving some of our natural beauty.
That was Pat Schlarbaum talking with Rick Zarwell of the Iowa Cold Water Coalition, describing the underground connections of water throughout Iowa and why it's important for all of us to be aware of what affects our water. Right now, we're going to take a little coffee break because we have fresh Morning Bell coffee. Our membership drive sponsors are Morning Bell Coffee, the Ames Chamber of Commerce, the Greater Iowa Credit Union, Mary Greeley Medical Center, Alluvial Brewing Company, and the Mucky Duck Pug.
As Susan says, this is an opportunity for all of you out there who enjoy our programming to support KHOI. We have a lot of folks who already are members and on board. You just mentioned those sponsors who have kindly been investing with the future of KHOI and supporting us in so many ways. And so for those of you who are out there listening to KHOI and are our regular listeners and appreciate the fact that we go out to your communities and highlight your festivals and special events coming up, this is your opportunity to support KHOI because we really are unique. You know, we have, of course, commercial radio and we have public radio, but KHOI is community radio. That means that it's local folks like you and people who've never done radio who are now doing radio and have their own shows. I'm thinking of that 8-track garage sale where we have 8-track recordings. There are a lot of folks here who, we have everything from opera to rap, special kinds of music programs that are done by people who've always loved that kind of music. And we have a lot of civic involvement, too. And that means that we cover all the things that are talked about locally for both Ames and surrounding area. And in that vein, we had an election yesterday, and Susan, there are some results out there.
There are some results, and in case you didn't know it, our Ames mayor is now John Hala, And our third board counsel is David Martin. The hospital board is Mary Kitchell and Beth Swenson. So we had all of these candidates on KHOI. So you got a chance to get some information about them here. We hope our coverage helped you to decide who to vote for yesterday. As you consider what level of support to give KHOI, remember not only the nature reporting and the civic reporting, but the variety of arts and entertainment we cover. Another specialty of ours is community theaters and sometimes even high school theater. We often have interviews with the directors and actors from the theaters within easy drive of Ames. One of our favorites is the Webster City Community Theater. We just learned they have a show opening this Friday, Making God Laugh by Sean Grennan. The title comes from Woody Allen, If You Want to Make God Laugh, Tell Him Your Plans. Webster City Community Theater. On November 10th, it'll be playing 10th, 11th, 17th, and 18th at 7:30, and November 12th and 19th at 2 p.m.
The best announcement of the day might be that tonight, Wednesday, November 8th, is the second Pantorium session and featuring Pink Neighbor. Pink Neighbor is a multi-instrumentalist duo comprised of Katie Inn and Eric Jarvis. Now, their music is influenced by the American Songbook, 60s lounge music, and film scores, rock and roll through the decades. They're based in Grinnell, Iowa, and write, perform, and produce their own original songs. It's a very special chance to hear this talented duo tonight here at the Pantorium. It will be broadcast live tonight at 7, and the time you'd normally listen to the rebroadcast of Local Talk is being occupied by that tonight. How exciting! And the music starts at 7 p.m. sharp. Try to arrive at 6:45 here at the Pantorium to get a good seat in the audience. And now here's a preview of Pink Neighbor, is Best That We Got.
That was Pink Neighbor, who's playing here tonight at 410 Douglas. And we hope to see you there. You have been listening to KHOI Community Radio. Your hosts have been Paul Wearson and Susan Franzen. That's me. Thank you for listening. Earlier in the show, we heard from Steve Lekwa, Adam Yankee, Rick Zarwell. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m. and noon, and today you can hear Pink Neighbor Tonight at the Pentorium. You can also hear us online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. KHOI is streaming live online at khoifm.org.
And today's show was engineered by Rebecca Reuter. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris. That's from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Where Do the Children Play by Cat Stevens and The Best We've Got by Pink. Neighbor coming tonight here to the Pentorium. So come tonight to hear Pink Neighbor.
Stay
Local
tuned.
Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show. So if you would like to try your hand at reporting, we'll train you. Come on and join the Local Talk team.
Stay tuned for Democracy Now! At the headline at the top of the hour and Morning Masterpieces at 9 a.m. Remember, you, the listener, are what make KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio. Funding for KHOI Radio is provided in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. We encourage you to shop local this holiday season. You can support Ames' growth while enjoying the wide array of local shopping and dining experiences that Ames independent businesses offer. From the Ames Chamber of Commerce, happy holidays. Let's shop local and grow Ames.
Support for KHOI comes from Mary Greeley Medical Center, providing inpatient and outpatient services on a continuum of care. Located at 1111 Duff Avenue in Ames. Find out more information at www.mgmc.org. That's mgmc.org.